Hi, welcome to Understory, Western Australia's only environmental radio program. I'm your host, Tom Wilson. Today we hear the environmental message of a Melbourne-based singer-songwriter, Penelope Swales, as well as from author Mark O'Connor on the recent population debate in Australia. Sometimes music speaks more eloquently than prose. Penelope Swales is a singer-songwriter who's been speaking environmental messages eloquently for a good 20 years. Earlier this year, I met Penelope at Culture in Fremantle, where she was performing with her group Totally Gorgeous. She told me about her song Black Carrie, a song which is a tribute to a German environmental activist called Black Carrie. The song has recently been recorded as a music video. Penelope gave me permission to play the song today on Understory and for the podcast of the show, and to tell you that this video has just been released onto YouTube. I really recommend you check it out. It's beautifully filmed in the forests of Victoria, and you can find it by following a link from my own blog, which is at tmwilson.org/blog. That's www.tmwilson.org/blog, and there's a link there to the video. Now to Penelope.
When I first met Black Carrie, met her in passing here and there. One day she turned and spoke to me with words. Silk and purple, bought at a market stall, and she sparkled at me darkly, small and ample. Her eyes were black and bright, like a sparrow. Frustrated and is lost by revolution heads with chips on their shoulders and media vultures too busy counting confrontation to count the cost. Protesting was violent. When I'm alone, I hear the earth crying. I hear it in my belly, deep and sore. Gone up country. a cacophony of buses and of streets. Deafens my ears to the caning and the pleas. My senses are dulled by many poisons.
That was Penelope Swales. And make sure that you do check out the beautiful environmental images in the film that goes with that song. And to see the film on YouTube, as I say, just go to my blog, www.tmwilson/blog. Now to Mark O'Connor, author of the book Overloading Australia, the book that Dick Smith has recently mailed to all Australian politicians. In August of last year, I asked you what the government's population policy was, and you basically said more, more, more. And
right.
in October of the same year, Rudd came on the 7:30 report and said he was a big Australia man, and the debate has exploded since then. Recently, he's appointed a population minister, is that right?
That's correct. The population debate has taken off. I've been writing a sort of summary of the most interesting parts, or sending on selected samples of what comes in each day from the articles that appear in the newspapers. And when I began, the articles genuinely discussing the population issue were still quite rare. It was only when you started collating them all that you realised there was quite a lot around. But 2 days ago, I found it took me all day to read the paper, the articles that had come out in Australian papers in one day on population. That's a debate that's exploded. And in a sense, it did explode from that moment when Kerry O'Brien amazed me and I think many other people by actually asking a question about the cost of population growth. I think the 730 report had ignored that for a good 20 years. But the occasion of it being raised perhaps was that Ken Henry had actually expressed the view that he, and he's a Treasury bureaucrat and on the economic side, he of all people expressed the view that he was profoundly pessimistic that Australia could cope with the environmental pressures of a population of 36 million. And that led to the question being asked on the 730 report. I think Rudd was so unused to being questioned on population that he'd forgotten what presumably his mind has recommended, the first rule, which is never take responsibility for population growth. Always pretend it's something that just happens and never have a higher profile on it than the opposition. Instead, he plunged in with both feet and said he was a big Australian man, that he basically welcomed this. It was a terrible mistake because, of course, he had had no mandate whatever to double Australia's immigration intake or to increase the baby bonus. These were sort of secret intentions. So I think Rudd got the message fairly quickly that he ought not to have said that, but I don't think there was any real repentance. He was back only a few weeks later to try and undo it by assuring Kerry O'Brien that it was just something that happened. He, to be perfectly honest, I don't have a view on that, he said. And, of course, he soon discovered that this was not the right answer either.
He'd like to not have a view.
As massive as that, and so you don't have a view on it. So since then, I think the debate really opened up because people's anger now had a target and an obvious object.
So who do you think are the major contributors to the population debate in Australia right now?
Well, a whole group of activists like myself started it. And I think the book Overloading Australia, which William Lines and I wrote, has been very important simply in that it puts all the arguments in one place. Previously, people would get terribly concerned with what population growth was doing, say, to their street or to the local wildlife. They'd go and see their local member and they'd be fobbed off with nonsense like, but what about the awful ageing population tsunami, or don't we have a terrible lack of labour? These arguments, which are an absolute nonsense, are well refuted in the book. And that's the advantage of it, that you can just point to the particular chapter where a particular cop-out is exploded.
Okay, well, let's just quickly rewind and go over a couple of things that we mentioned in our interview last year, just to refresh people's memory. So how many people do we take into Australia each year through immigration?
Well, it had been as low as 70,000. That's net, excessive immigrants over emigrants. Net migration is always the crucial factor. That seems to have risen. I think the latest figure is something over 400,000 has been counted by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It's claimed that some of these are temporary immigrants, or rather a temporary loophole that was created by the overseas student scandals, but I'm not sure those will ever be closed off either.
So that's excluding tourists, for example?
Yes, we do exclude tourists because the ABS... it notes if someone who comes in on a tourist visa doesn't leave, they will eventually appear on the statistics as an immigrant. But in general, a very large flow in and out of tourists who are only staying a few weeks will make no difference to net migration. It'll make a huge difference to the world's greenhouse, of course. But as yet, we're tolerating and even encouraging those kind of international, rather frivolous movements.
And just to put it in a global context, that as a proportion of Australia's population translated into a percentage of growth is quite high.
It's stunningly high. It's 2.1% are the last two quarterly figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Now, 2.1% population growth per year is more than a third world rate. To give you a comparison, Indonesia is growing at 1.2%, roughly half that. The world as a whole is growing at also about 1.1 or 1.2%. So,
and how about European countries?
Oh, they're way, way below that. For industrialised countries, we're about six times the average. There are these three eccentric countries, Canada, Australia and the USA. They're all Anglo-Celtic pioneering countries with a pioneering complex. All got into this syndrome of high population growth. But even so, Australia is way above them in its per capita growth.
And I noticed that the Australian Conservation Foundation recently listed nominated population growth as a
process.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very
threatening ecological process.
Again, I think the activists have prevailed largely by winning the public debate to the point where both the Greens and the ACF that had been sluggish on this, sluggish, not that all their members are sluggish on it, some are quite passionate and strong, but overall they weren't doing much. Both the Greens and the ACF have become much more courageous, as Sir Humphrey would say, or you might simply say that, you know, those who always were courageous have started to call the shots rather more. In particular, one of the things that was always a problem that worried us greatly when we were writing the book is the confusion people had between refugees and immigrants. And it was very hard to talk about, you know, the need to reduce population, which implied the need to reduce immigration, without someone saying, oh, you're scapegoating refugees or you're being inhumane, etc. Now, that problem has almost vanished. For instance, I was on Australia Talks last night, where a few of the callers were trying to conflate it, and the presenter, without any prompting from me, was very quick to correct them and point out that our so-called humanitarian intake, which includes about 50% refugees, is merely 14,000 a year, just under 14,000. And, you know, that is trivial when you're actually growing by something, a net migration of something more like 400,000. It's so small, as the presenter rightly points out, it makes no difference.
And so we could actually increase that and decrease our overall intake of population.
Oh, you could double it and you know, still fit that within zero net migration if you wanted to. But the odd thing is that the refugee advocates are now also strongly supporting this point because they too don't want the case for refugees to be confused with the population debate, which they realise is now up and running. So they too are often found, even on programs like Q&A, which would never talk about the cost of population growth, but went on endlessly because of the producer's personal slant or the presenter's, about refugees and asylum seekers. They too are demanding an absolute separation of those two issues. That's freed up the population debate and I suppose also freed up the refugee debate.
Another argument people come up with is that the world's population's growing anyway, so it's just isolating ourselves from a global problem if we restrict immigration to Australia. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, one component of that is fatalism. You know, it's going to happen, so why fight, why resist, which I don't think is a good argument. And the other thing is, let's think totally globally. Well, the problem with that is that the world is not actually currently, you know, set up as a population socialist thing. It's actually a free enterprise system where those nations that keep their populations in check tend to prosper. And in fact, if you look at the nations that have the highest wealth or the highest per capita GDP on the world wealth table, which is usually in most arguments considered to be, you know, what we're aiming at, of I think nine of them, only one, the USA, has a large population. All the others have populations of 8 million or less. Some have populations lower than Melbourne. So it's quite clear that, you know, those countries that keep their population small benefit. In that sense, you know, it's what people usually argue for if they're private enterprise types, that you know, each person should manage their own finances and each country should manage its own population to keep it in balance with its environmental and resource allowances, as it were. This is also, you know, what any conservationist should want, because it's only by allowing countries that keep their population small to benefit thereby that you can actually get the political power and will to keep population in some kind of check. The interesting case is the two countries that have notably controlled their population and totally against their prior record and culture in the last few decades are China and Iran. And in both cases, it was because they had at the time quarreled with the West. Immigration was not an option. By contrast, Mexico and the Philippines have been allowed to have this steady outward flow of people into particularly the USA, not at a rate that actually takes off the population or relieves the population pressure on either of those countries, but at a rate which burdens the USA enormously with extra people and seemingly also encourages people back home to go on having large families in the hope that this perhaps the sixth child will be the lucky one who gets to the USA and brings the whole family in. So it's a very interesting argument, but in general, I don't think that we can, I mean, it's quite clear we can't help heavily populated countries. We couldn't take off any significant percentage of the overpopulation of India or China.
Just to swing back things back to Australia, so very simple question. What size do you think we should be aiming for in 2050?
Well, ideally no more than at present. The Australian Academy of Science told us back in 1994 that 23 million should be the upper limit. They weren't advocating that we went there. We were at something like 19 million at the time. It was rather a limit to stay away from, but definitely we would run into serious diseconomies of scale from there on, as indeed we're now seeing in all our cities. And it is, in fact, you know, the fact that people are really hurting in Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney that's largely turned the population debate around. Unfortunately, we're now at 22 million and a little over. We're not the sort of country in which people are going to be stopped from having as many children as they want, though we can cut out absurdities like actually bribing them to have more children. Baby bonuses are an absurdity, of course, and certainly should be cut out. But even so, it's likely that sheer natural increase, the surplus of births over deaths, will add at least another 1 million Australians. So it's very difficult to see us pulling up, you know, in a democratic way and without any coercion at much under 23 to 24 million. And while I don't sort of, you know, take lightly the effects of adding an extra 2 million people, mainly to our already overcrowded, you know, major cities, that's, you know, infinitely preferable to the notion of being 36 million and still growing, which is where the government would have us.
I was going to also ask you about the increase in housing prices and the price of rent in Perth. Is that attributable to population growth on a national scale?
It is, yeah. Yes, one of the great costs, if you're thinking in purely selfish human terms, you know, not about what we're doing to all the other species in Australia, where we have a unique marsupial world to conserve, but if you think just in terms of what it does to humans, one of the great costs and the great impoverishments is the increase in house prices, which perverse economists and people from the big end of town represent as good, because as Ross Garnaut pointed out, high house prices are a classic way of moving money from the poor to the rich, and even from the lower middle class to the upper middle class. It impoverishes most people for most of their lives simply to pay off a house, and this is primarily the cost of the land. The option that young couples have nowadays is live in whoop-whoop or pay through the nose, and it adds to the cost of everything. State governments think they make a lot of money out of housing tax, but of course they then have to pay for public servants who expect to live in middle-class suburbs where the price of a house is astronomical, so the wages have to cover that, so they're pouring the money they get into a leaky bucket in that sense. And every good, every service you buy is inflated by the cost of wages necessary to pay for the cost of housing. For the ordinary person towards the bottom of the thing, they basically spend all their life as a mortgage slave, really trying to pay off the house. You get the
name. What if they're renting?
Well, in rent, you're in much the same situation too, that it puts the pressure on rents enormously.
I've noticed that in Fremantle, where I live, the price of rents in the last 5 years has increased dramatically.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the greatest single political push that keeps all our governments locked into high population growth is the push from the Property Council and associated groups, the Business Council and so on, but the ability to fleece other Australians by pushing up the price of property is, you know, an enormous incentive. And, of course, these groups are able to pay very, very large donations to the political parties to make sure that their voice is heard.
All right, well, we're going to have to finish the interview off there. But thanks very much for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure. Connor. Pleasure, Tom.
Thanks for listening to Understory, RTR 92.1 FM's weekly environmental radio show. See you next week.